from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, and this week for Michael Krasny. UC Berkeley was home to the free speech movement in the 1960s, but today Berkeley is often embroiled in bitter disagreements over the rights of extreme conservative speakers to appear on or near campus. The new dean of Cal's law school, Erwin Chemerinsky, has co-authored a new book titled Free Speech on Campus. It examines the tension between respecting freedom of expression and the need to provide a safe and respectful learning environment for all students. He joins us for the hour, and we'll get started with Forum right after the news. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, in today for Michael Krasny. Well, it seems that often these days, college campuses like UC Berkeley have to resolve conflicts between two competing values, protecting academic freedom and freedom of expression on the one hand, and maintaining a safe and respectful learning environment for students on the other. Our guest this hour contends that too often that dispute is settled on the side of restricting or punishing speech that's offensive to many people on campus. Extreme conservatives like Ann Coulter and Milo Yiannopoulos, for example. UC Berkeley Law School Dean Erwin Chemerinsky and his counterpart from UC Irvine Law School have co-authored a new book. It's titled Free Speech on Campus, and Dean Chemerinsky is here to talk about it. Welcome.
It's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you for having me.
Talked to you so many times on the phone, the first time I've met you, and you've been around. You were at USC for a while. You were at UC Irvine, Duke, and now you're in Berkeley. What's the difference? I know you've just gotten here, but what are you noticing?
Well, I became dean at UC Berkeley on July 1st, and I'm thrilled to be here. Berkeley is a much larger law school than UC Irvine.
I started the law school there.
I was the founding dean at UC Irvine, was there for 9 years. It was an amazing experience. We, counting the graduates from May 13th, have 460 alums. At Berkeley, we have 17,000 alums. The size of the student population, the size of the faculty, is about triple what it was in Irvine. Also, Berkeley, I'm learning, is a very different kind of community than Irvine. Berkeley is very urban. Irvine is very suburban. And I'm really enjoying being here. But I have to say the only negative is the weather. I wasn't prepared for summer in the Bay Area. I said to my wife last week, if this is summer, I really worry what winter is going to be like.
Yeah, but you don't have any of the humidity that you have like at Duke, I suppose, or even down south. There's not a lot of humidity. But the political climate is different, too.
It is. This is just a wonderful area in every way, and I'm so thrilled to have the opportunity to be dean at Berkeley.
And you're coming in with a new chancellor as well, Carol Crist.
I could not be more impressed with Carol Crist. She interviewed me as part of the process of choosing a new dean. She's the person I negotiated with. I've now had a number of meetings with her. I've heard her speak many times. I don't think Berkeley could have a better chancellor of anyone literally on the planet.
Well, let me ask you, because your book is about free speech on campus, and one of the things that Chancellor Crist said in the past couple weeks is that she's going to have basically, she wants to make this a year of free speech at Berkeley. Did you talk with her about that?
I have had the opportunity to speak with her about it. I've also heard her speak about it. I so agree with her that Berkeley should represent free speech. And she's committed in many ways that that be true on campus, welcoming speakers from all along the ideological spectrum, holding a number of events on campus and throughout the state about free speech, and then also having a series of debates, dialogues on various topics so Berkeley can model what free speech on a campus really should be about.
Do you think that in the past year or so, where we've seen some violent clashes, speeches by Ann Coulter, for example, have been canceled, Milo Yiannopoulos, same thing. If you had it to do over and you had been there, would you have urged the university to handle it differently?
Hindsight is a tremendous benefit. It's especially a benefit when I wasn't here. So everything I know is second and third hand. I think with regard to Milo Yiannopoulos' appearance in January, I think that Chancellor Dirks tried very hard to have sufficient police presence to allow him to speak. It was only when there was a real threat to public safety, people coming through with Molotov cocktails and violence was occurring, that he felt he needed to cancel that. And I know that what Chancellor Crist is trying to do now is take whatever it requires in terms of resources to make sure that Milo Yiannopoulos and Ann Coulter and Steve Bannon can speak. Because I know that Chancellor Crist is committed, as I am, as you are, that all ideas and views should be able to be expressed on campus, that no matter how offensive they are, they should be able to be expressed, and then the response should be more speech.
And I should mention that Carol Crist is going to be on Forum Monday, so we'll hear more from her then. You write in this book, Free Speech on Campus, very timely. You write that you and your colleague Howard Gilman write that these kinds of issues and conflicts have been present on college campuses for a very long time. What's different, do you think, about the sort of variety of issues, the nature of the issues that we're seeing and dealing with now versus in the past?
Obviously, the issues at any point in time are those of greatest salience. So when I was in college, it was anti-Vietnam War protests. A bit earlier than that, it was the civil rights protests. Now it's anti-Trump protests, or now you also have the white supremacist demonstrations. I think one of the biggest differences on campus is the attitudes of the students towards free speech. The last 2 years, Howard Gilman and I taught a class at University of California, Irvine, titled Free Speech on Campus. And we were struck by how much our students wanted to protect other students on campus. This is the first generation to grow up being taught that bullying is wrong, and they've really internalized that message. Also, we were surprised at how little our students knew about the history of free speech on campus or in society. And so we were surprised at how much the students wanted to give authority to campus officials to restrict speech to make it an inclusive community.
I think you say in the book that you ask students to put their hands up on a particular issue. Should they side with free speech or side with, protecting students? And it was 15-0 on the side of silencing speech.
Howard and I were both stunned at how much the students, in their desire to create an inclusive community, were willing to restrict speech. And indeed, it was that observation that led to this book.
What is it, aside from sort of a sense of maybe fairness or altruism, strong value on equality, what is it about these students? What else is it about students of this generation, millennials and those who are even younger than millennials and you mentioned the lack of maybe historic knowledge about the movement.
Campuses, thankfully, are much more diverse and inclusive than they used to be. And I think the students want to make sure that the historically excluded minorities are made to feel included and welcome. Often the unpleasant speech, the offensive speech, is directed at those minorities. And I think the desire to protect them especially is driving some of the goals of restricting speech.
So part of that also is educating them about how these free speech, the movement and the rights developed in the past 30, 40 years?
Absolutely. I think generally there's a real problem in this country with regard to a lack of civic education. One part of that is a lack of understanding of the history of speech and also an awareness of the importance of speech for the democratic process. One of the things that I thought so important for students to realize is that the very groups that they most want to protect, racial minorities, benefited tremendously from the existence of free speech, the civil rights movement being an example of that.
You mention in the book these microaggressions, which have become an issue on different campuses, sort of small things to many, but things that are upsetting to people of color, women, LGBT folks. Are you saying that maybe students of this generation are a little too sensitive?
I think it's patronizing to say to students, you're being too sensitive. I think we need to take into account their feelings. The question is, what then? So I think we should be sensitive to microaggressions. On the other hand, the response shouldn't be to punish people who engage in microaggressions. So one of the things we say in the book is there should be educational programs for students, like at orientation, about the kinds of things they might say that would be hurtful to others. But we shouldn't be punishing those who engage in speech like microaggressions.
And you're saying, too, then, that there's a value to maybe, listening to things you disagree with and maybe toughening up a little bit?
Well, I think the nature of a college campus, as I've said, is that all ideas and views must be expressed. There's a lot of talk about so-called safe spaces. Safe spaces can never be gained by suppressing ideas. Part of being in a university is we will be exposed to ideas that may offend us. That's part of thinking things through. But I still want students to feel safe and comfortable on campus. It just can't be gained by suppressing speech.
So how do you resolve that conflict?
I think there are many things that campuses can do to make students feel safe, to make them feel included. I sent out a statement to the entire law school community on Monday, the first day of classes, talking about how much we want to create a community where people are always respectful, civil, kind to one another, where all ideas can be expressed, even if it means we're offended. But I also said that expression of hate has no place in our community. I said that just because there's a First Amendment right to say something doesn't mean that it should be said. We need to have orientation and training programs for students. We need to create forums for students to be able to express themselves. But none of this should take the form of suppressing or punishing speech.
So you're saying there are things that shouldn't be said, but the university needs to protect the right of those to say those things, whether it's Milo Yiannopoulos or Ann Coulter, Steve Bannon, whoever it is.
It's true in a university and it's true in the larger society. There's a difference between whether you have a First Amendment right to say something and whether you should say it. You have a First Amendment right to say a lot of things on the air, but there's many things you won't say even if they wouldn't lead to you being punished. In day-to-day conversation, there's things we could say, but we're taught from a young age we shouldn't say. And so the message, I think, within a law school, within a campus is, you may have the right to say it, but just in terms of the kind of community we want to be, those are things you shouldn't be saying.
But people do say. And that's the rub, isn't it? Where you have provocative speakers who come in and they want the confrontation. They want the reaction.
I deeply believe that Milo Yiannopoulos and Ann Coulter and Steve Bannon have the right to speak on the Berkeley campus and every other campus, and that the campus has the duty to protect the right to speak. But I also think that students who are upset by it should be able to engage in speech. They should be able to engage in counter demonstrations. They should be able to engage in teach-ins. They should be able to engage in leafleting, because the best response to the speech we don't like is more speech.
And you write in the book that our position is absolute. Campuses can never censor or punish expression of ideas, no matter how offensive. And you also say that that concept is more important on university campuses and academia than almost anywhere else. Why?
Universities exist to be the place where ideas can be explored. And we talk in the book about the history of academic freedom. If there's any place that can really be a marketplace for ideas, it's a university. I've always taken the position that I want my classroom to feel a safe space for all students, but I want every student anywhere on the ideological spectrum to feel comfortable expressing himself or herself.
Do you feel, and I realize you've just started at Berkeley, but is there enough of a diversity of opinion within classes in Berkeley? Because that's a criticism. Republicans feel that they're vastly outnumbered and they don't feel safe speaking up.
I hope so. I deeply believe that the law school should be a place where we have the entire ideological spectrum represented. I hope on the faculty we always have conservative and liberals and libertarians and everybody else of different views. And I want the same thing for students. And I want them all to feel comfortable expressing that within the law school and in the classroom. And a university in that way can be a model for the rest of society about reasoned and civil discourse. We should always be able to disagree without being disagreeable about it.
There has been a lot of criticism, not just of Berkeley, but for many, many years, that college campuses are hotbeds of radical left-wing thinking. And President Trump, I think, earlier this year talked about sort of threatened public funding for universities that don't allow free speech or stifles free speech in some way. Do Republicans, not necessarily the president, but is there a kernel of truth in what they're saying?
I think there's definitely a kernel of truth that at times campuses have not been as hospitable to speech as they should be. And there have been some instances like the Charles Murray incident on the East Coast last year where conservative speakers weren't being able to speak. I think it is so crucial, as we're talking about now, that all speakers, all ideas be able to be expressed and that campuses be there for liberal and conservative speakers alike.
You have a lot of examples in the book of situations, cases that have happened all over the country. The one that stuck in my mind was a fraternity group of guys at the University of Oklahoma. They're on a bus going to some fraternity event, and a couple of students start a chant that's a racist sort of chant, and I believe the students end up getting expelled. What's wrong with that picture?
You described
and
it exactly.
And I should say, they use the N-word numerous times.
It was a year and a half ago, and it was it was at the University of Oklahoma. And just to set the stage, it was a group of fraternity members, all dressed in formal, were going to a fraternity event. Two members of the fraternity led the members of the fraternity in a deeply racist chant. It used the N-word. It even spoke praisingly of lynchings. And the president of the University of Oklahoma, David Boren, then expelled those students. Had the students sued they would have won under the First Amendment because the speech, though offensive, was still constitutionally protected. Now, my understanding is the students just wanted it all to go away, and they didn't sue. But as a matter of constitutional law, there's no doubt it was speech protected by the First Amendment.
Surprising that there wasn't some legal action, huh?
What I understand is that the students were deeply embarrassed after the video of this went viral, and they didn't want to engage in litigation.
What do you hear or what do you expect to hear from students, those 15 students who raised their hands at your class at UC Irvine, you know, when they're confronted with this notion that, you know, we disagree with you and, in fact, we're going to implement policies that allow this speech to happen, whether or not you like it?
My hope is that when students are educated about free speech, they're going to be much more willing to protect this constitutional right. One of the interesting things we did in the seminar we taught was poll them, like on the University of Oklahoma example, at the beginning of the class and then again at the end of the class. And we saw very different results after they'd studied the history of free speech and thought about the underlying principles.
You use a lot of examples in the book of case law that occurred here in California involving Communist Party, labor organizers, people wearing objectionable shirts with statements about the draft. So thinking evolves, both legal thinking as well as public thinking.
And, of course, what those examples most tell us, what history most reminds us is people always want to punish the speech they don't like. It doesn't come instinctively to any of us to want to allow the messages that we disagree with. Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes said, what we most need free speech for is the speech we hate. And I think he was right.
And, of course, groups like the ACLU have gotten in big trouble just very recently, in fact, down in Charlottesville for going to bat for the group that organized that march. It is a hot-button issue.
And it's long been the most intense disagreement I ever had with my father was over whether the Nazi Party should have the right to march in Skokie, Illinois. Skokie at the time, a suburb of Chicago, was predominantly Jewish with a large number of Holocaust survivors. My father just couldn't understand why they should have the right to march and so upset the people there. And, of course, my position then and my position now is that's what free speech is like. And if you can stop the Nazis because you dislike what they're saying, tomorrow those in power might stop us because they dislike what we're saying.
Yeah. Erwin Chemerinsky is my guest this hour. He's written a book called Free Speech on Campus with a colleague down in UC Irvine, Howard Gilman. And we're talking with him about free speech on campus and also in other places. And I'm wondering your thoughts about this coming weekend. The National Park Service just gave a permit with a lot of conditions to a right-wing group that's going to have a rally at Chrissy Field. Is that the right call?
There's no doubt. Had the National Park Service denied their ability to speak, they would have sued. They would have won. So the key is to make sure that there's reasonable time, place, and manner restriction on speech. We've talked a lot about the importance of speech, but what we haven't said is free speech is never absolute. Justice Holmes also long ago said there's no right to falsely shout fire in a crowded theater. One of the things that the government can do, that a campus can do, is have what's called time, place, and manner restrictions, so long as they leave open adequate alternative places for speech. And that's what the government is trying to do here.
You're in Berkeley now at the law school there and, of course, the Bay Area generally and nowhere more so than Berkeley is a very democratic, deep blue, left of center place. There is going to be a lot of resistance, is there not, to giving a forum and a place and protecting this kind of speech.
But there's no doubt that the only way that those on the left can have the right to speak is to also safeguard the ability of those on the right to speak. Free speech is a neutral principle. And so while I'm progressive, I think this is something where I'm in total agreement with conservatives. Everyone should have the ability on a college campus to express their views.
This weekend, there's going to be – we'll see what happens. There's going to be counter protests all over. What counsel would you give to people? Should people go and confront the organizers? Should they go to peace vigils elsewhere, as the mayor of San Francisco is urging people to do? What do you think?
Violent confrontation serves no one's goal. And to me, it's the antithesis of what freedom of speech is all about. The best response to the speech we don't like is more speech. So confronting the white supremacist demonstrators serves no purpose. If there's going to be anything that conservatives, a counter-demonstration, a larger, better demonstration. One of the benefits of hate speech is we get to respond to hate speech and explain why it's against the values we stand for and the kind of community we want to be part of.
You write that of all the rights spelled out in the Constitution, that the freedom of speech is in some ways the most important. It's foundational.
There can't be a democracy without freedom of speech. We have to have the ability to criticize government in order to be able to change government. We've got to be able to criticize the policies that exist in order to change those policies. There's never been a democracy without freedom of speech.
You also discuss in the book, one of the real flashpoints on campuses has been when pro-Muslim or pro-Palestinian speakers come on, and the Jewish students often complain. They feel threatened. They feel that they're being targeted. Did you encounter that at UC Irvine?
Very much so at University of California, Irvine. There are many very famous, highly publicized incidents of those confrontations at UC Irvine. And again, the most important thing is to remember the basic principles that apply here. The pro-Palestinian students have the right to speak, even if it makes the Jewish students feel uncomfortable. The Jewish students have the right to speak, even if it makes the pro-Palestinian students feel uncomfortable. But there's never a right to engage in what's called a true threat, never a right to threaten somebody else. There's never a right to engage in what the law would regard as harassment. And though it's very narrowly defined, there's never a right to engage in incitement.
Do you think that there should be an effort on the part of universities to work with the groups and the people that are, what some would say, using hate speech to talk them out of it or to ask them to moderate what they're saying? I mean, not to restrict it, but to create a dialogue? Or is that you just need to stand back and let them say it and then respond accordingly?
I'll give you a law professor answer. Yes and no. Yes, I think campuses need to express what kind of community they want to be. I think it's important for deans, for chancellors to say that hate speech is inconsistent with what we want to be as a community. And when it occurs, I think it's important for campus administrators to speak out and say, they had the right to say it, but we so abhor what they said. On the other hand, I don't think that campuses can try to control student speech. I think that's a mistake. I can talk to students and explain why I hope they don't do it, but ultimately it's still their First Amendment right.
How much pushback are you hearing at this, early part of your tenure over there to the concepts that you're talking about?
Well, it's obviously too soon. School started just this week. But at least from what I've heard, there's enormous support for what Carol Christ is trying to do at Berkeley.
Talking this hour with Erwin Chemerinsky, he and Howard Gilman have written a book called Free Speech on Campus. If you'd like to weigh in on this topical topic, everyone seems to be talking about it these days, given what's happening this weekend in the Bay Area, give us a ring. It's 866-733-6786. The phone lines are already full. Very unusual. I haven't given out the phone number yet. But again, it's 866-733-6786. You can also email your thoughts to kqed.org. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Michael Krasny. Stay with us. And welcome back to Forum. Scott Schaefer here this morning. My guest this hour is Erwin Chemerinsky. He's written a book with Howard Gilman from UC Irvine. Erwin Chemerinsky, the new dean of the law school at UC Berkeley. The book is called Free Speech on Campus. We're going to get to your calls and questions, but we have some news breaking this morning. The state Supreme Court has ruled on the constitutionality of Proposition 66. You may recall that's the one that passed. There were two death penalty measures on the ballot in November, Prop 66. Expedited executions. Marisa Lagos from KQED's California Politics and Government desk has read or skimmed the 120-page opinion. What did they decide?
I mean, essentially, they're upholding most of Prop 66, but they are saying that this idea that all appeals should be exhausted within 5 years is unrealistic and should be read as a directive, not a mandatory deadline. This was, a pretty strong opinion from there's only one dissent on this court. Interestingly, they note that they're only considering the objections that were brought by opponents of this, not that, they're basically saying individual prisoners could bring other objections to Prop 66 moving forward. When they made the oral arguments, it was really interesting because this was sold to voters saying, we're going to speed this up and it's going to be done within 5 years. And when the attorney general and the backers of this proposition got before the court to defend it, they said, well, that 5 years is really not a mandatory deadline.
It's a goal.
It is a goal. And the opposition said, no, that's not fair. So the only dissent from Queller is basically saying, you know what? This should be a genuine enforceable 5-year deadline. And so because of that, it should be struck down. They're not disagreeing like entirely. This isn't a strong dissent.
And of course, it's been, I think, 11 years or more since the last execution in California. And of course, that frustrates a lot of crime victims and their families and district attorneys and others who would like to see it proceed more quickly. Of course, Erwin Chemerinsky, I know you filed a brief on behalf of the critics of Prop 66. What's your read? And let me just say, Marisa, thanks. I know you're reporting on this, so if you need to leave, good, but thank you for coming in. What are your – I know you haven't read the decision, but what's at stake here?
Right. I did want to make the disclosure since I've been with you since it came down. I've not had the chance to read it. I think that this is an important victory for those who opposed Prop 66, not the whole victory they wanted. And here's why. Prop 66, as written, created a mandatory 5-year deadline. It is impossible to meet this in California, given the nature of the appellate process, and most importantly, given the lack of experienced attorneys to handle death penalty appeals. So what the court said is, we're not going to treat this as a mandatory deadline. Instead, we're going to treat it as directive. The question is, what will that mean in practice? I don't think we can tell at this stage. It's key that the court said here, we're just dealing with whether this is facially unconstitutional. We'll still allow as-applied challenges and issues to be raised. So I think this is just a start of the litigation, not the end of the litigation.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's something we were all watching is like how – so there's other parts of this ballot measure that say tell the courts that a broader class of lawyers are going to have to take these cases. You could see a prisoner arguing this lawyer is not qualified to do this.
Well, I think wasn't there a separate lawsuit from attorneys saying you can't make us take these cases? What if we have a religious objection to the death penalty?
And also, you want people who are facing the death penalty to have counsel who are experienced, counsel who have handled death cases before. There's an enormous lag time between when somebody needs an attorney in a death case and when one is provided. That accounts for more of the delay than anything else. The problem with Prop 66 is it doesn't deal with that problem. You can't magically say, let's have more lawyers qualified to handle death cases unless there's some mechanism for providing them.
And quickly, I mean, Liu makes this case in
Goodwin
his
Liu, Justice
yeah,
Liu.
Goodwin Liu, Justice Goodwin Liu, in his concurring opinion, where he says, and I quote, you know, the judicial council, the legislature can't simply wave a magic wand and speed up a process that takes 2 decades to 5 years. And he's essentially saying this isn't grounded in the realities of California's process. And so I think this is pretty strong. In addition to lacking strict enforceability, the 5-year limit cannot serve as a realistic benchmark to guide courts or the judicial council. So I think there's real questions moving forward about whether this is going to change anything in California.
Well, and in fact, that was one of the arguments that critics of Prop 66 made is this is a false promise. This is not something that can realistically be put into place. And it sounds like the court today is justifying that criticism.
Yeah, and the dissenting opinion basically really honed in on that. This issue, you know, they're saying that, well, voters in the majority opinion, they're saying voters were told this, but they weren't told how. And so that's kind of how they get around it. Collar is saying, you know, that's kind of not how our system should work.
All right. Marisa Lagos from KQED's California Politics and Government Desk. Thanks for the breaking news. Appreciate it.
Enjoy your hour.
And Erwin Chemerinsky, we should also mention that there currently is no acceptable execution protocol in California. There have been objections to the use of the three drug cocktail, and their drug manufacturers are now saying you can't use it for that. It's not intended to kill people. So there are a lot of problems with capital punishment.
You're absolutely right in that regard, and not the least of which is the real concern about executing innocent individuals. We saw just a couple of days ago the governor of Missouri staying in execution because of DNA evidence that indicated that a person who'd been convicted and spent many years on death row was actually innocent. One of the concerns about speeding up executions of Prop 66 would is it could lead to the execution of innocent people.
I'm wondering, you know, there is or there will soon be a vacancy on the Supreme Court. Governor Brown has appointed three of the four of the seven justices. He'll have a fourth. One of the ones he's appointed, Tino Cuellar, is the was in the dissent today in this opinion, seeming that perhaps the court should have gone further, if not striking down Prop 66. And I'm wondering what's missing on the state Supreme Court. What kind of person would you like to see the governor appoint? For one thing, there's no geographic diversity. There's no one from Southern California.
Well, having spent 30 of the last 35 years in Southern California, I believe in the importance of having someone from Southern California. I think that Jerry Brown's appointments to the California Supreme Court have been superb. By any measure, Goodwin Liu, Tino Cuellar, Leandra Kruger are outstanding. They add to the intellectual firepower of the court. They add to the diversity of the court. I think another nominee in that mold who's just truly outstanding would be wonderful.
Although none of those three had been on the bench before. Does that matter?
Obviously, judicial experience matters. I think it would be good to have people on both the state Supreme Court and the United States Supreme Court who have experience as trial judges. Because one of the things a state Supreme Court has to do is give guidance to the trial judges in California. And if you don't have trial experience, it's much harder to do that. So it would be nice to have that on the court. But there's many things I can criticize Jerry Brown for, but his picks for the California Supreme Court by any measure have been stellar.
What would you criticize him for?
His lack of support for the University of California and especially the University of California law schools.
Okay, very good. And he's a graduate of Cal.
And a graduate of Yale Law School.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. And I think all three of those justices he appointed are all from Yale. Is that correct? Well, we'll figure that out later. I think it may
That's
be.
That's right. They are.
Yeah.
Now that I'm thinking about it, they're terrific.
Okay. Let's go to the phones. Mark in San Jose, you're on with Erwin Chemerinsky. Or maybe not. We'll see if we can try. It sounds like that call was dropped. Let's go to Ruth Ann in El Cerrito.
Good morning. I wanted to ask Professor Chemerinsky if he could make a designation between his advocacy for all speech being protected, all in quotes, and what is considered fighting words. Are those, I mean, if it's going to incite imminent illegal or dangerous action, because I think that's a lot of what came up when the Berkeley instances, that there was concern that it was going to incite.
And just describe what fighting words is a legal term, too.
Let me separate this into three parts. The latter part of what was said uses the word incitement. The Supreme Court, in a case called Brandenburg v. Ohio in 1969, said, if it's speech that incites illegal activity, it's not protected by the First Amendment. But to constitute incitement, there has to be a substantial likelihood of imminent illegal activity, and the speech has to be directed at causing imminent illegal activity. Second, in 1942, in a case called Chaplinsky v. New Hampshire, the Supreme Court said that fighting words are not protected by the First Amendment. Fighting words are words directed at another that would produce a violent response. But since 1942, and so we're now talking 77 years ago, the Supreme Court has never again upheld a fighting words conviction. So in theory, fighting words are unprotected by the First Amendment, but in reality, no one has been punished for fighting words since that decision. Now, finally, in terms of what happened in January, I don't think it was so much about incitement or fighting words. What happened was, as I understand, a group of individuals, maybe as many as 150 in masks, were running through and throwing Molotov cocktails and committing violence. Chancellor Dirks believed couldn't protect public safety and allow Yiannopoulos to speak at that time. And with great reluctance, he had to be able to cancel that. I don't think it was that Yiannopoulos was inciting illegal activity. It wasn't fighting words. It was the reaction of the audience meant that public safety was in jeopardy.
And there's an obligation, too, on the part of not only law enforcement, but perhaps people who oppose the speech to, you know, call out anarchists and others who come and with a very deliberate intention of causing chaos and violence.
And that's not free speech. There's no right to disrupt somebody else from having their ability to speak. And as I think Carol Christ will tell you on Monday, she's spending millions of dollars that the campus doesn't really have to protect the ability of Yiannopoulos and Ben Shapiro and Ann Coulter to come on campus. That's her duty as chancellor.
All right, Ruth Ann, thanks very much for the call. Again, the number to ring us at is 866-733-6786. Let's go now to Oakland. And Chris, you're on with Dean Chemerinsky.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I just wanted to kind of bring a little bit of nuance to the conversation. I mean, I'm happy to let David Duke stand in Sproul Hall and shout hate, but, like, do we really need to give him the forum of Zellerbach Hall?
That's a good question.
Sure. The campus has to make sure that there's a reasonable place for a speaker to reach an audience, but it has to also be consistent with the function of the campus. So if a class is being held in a particular place, that doesn't mean that the speaker can come and be in that place. What's reasonable is going to be contextual. So sometimes it's better to have a controversial speaker in an auditorium because you can secure the perimeter, you can make sure nobody has weapons, as opposed to being outdoors. Sometimes outdoors is the best, but that's going to depend on the speaker, the time, the place, the manner, fitting what we've talked about, the college, universities, the government. Always can have time, place, and manner restrictions so long as they leave open adequate alternative places for the speech.
But it can't be based, can it, on what the message is, right?
That's absolutely right. With regard to an auditorium or a place, it has to be equally available to all ideas and viewpoints.
Chris, does that respond to your point?
Yeah, thank you. Do we really need to have a robust debate about, you know, white supremacy? Like, we don't need a forum for these ideas. They've been debated 100 years ago, and they've been found to be abhorrent. So, like, why do we need to give a forum for all free speech?
It's a great question. It's the most fundamental question. And I think the answer is that if we prohibit the speech, we're not eliminating the idea. We're just driving it underground. And the best response to it is more speech. When white supremacists come forward, denouncing their views is most beneficial. And also keep in mind, the only way our speech can be secure tomorrow is to make the speech we don't like today. It's easy to say white supremacists should be silenced, but wouldn't white supremacists in the South, when they were in power, have silenced civil rights protesters in the 1960s?
Chris, thanks very much for the call. Let's go now to Stanford and Janai. Welcome.
Hi. Okay, Dean Chemerinsky. I wanted to bring up the point of moral relativism and the fact that not all opinions are equally valid or deserve equal consideration. So the question you were saying kind of got to this. While everyone has the right to free speech, not everyone deserves a university platform to espouse their ideas, at least without qualification. So racists don't deserve megaphones. Is there no responsibility for the university to qualify the views and authority of their speakers?
Well, that's where you get into the restrictions.
Sure. The question is, who should decide what speech is worthy and what speech we can suppress? The First Amendment says we're not going to let the government make that choice. The First Amendment says that the government can't say racist speech is unacceptable and pro-civil rights speech, well, that's good, so we're going to allow it.
Although, I just didn't mean to interrupt, but
of course.
Is this different for a public university like UC versus a private one like Stanford?
It's very much different. Well, now I'm going to have to qualify. The First Amendment of the Constitution applies only to the government. Private institutions don't have to comply with the First Amendment. That's true of all constitutional rights. The Constitution is meant to limit what government at all levels can do. Private entities, private universities aren't governed by the Constitution. But in California, there is a law, it was called the Leonard Law, that says that private universities, for that matter, private high schools, cannot punish speech that could not be punished by a public university or a public high school. So Stanford has to comply with the principles of the First Amendment, not because of the Constitution, but because of the California statute that says so.
Janai, does that respond to your question?
You
don't like the
not
answer.
Not completely. I don't like the answer. I still think that does the university have a responsibility to at least qualify the views, or do you think it should just be presented without qualification? Here is Milo. Here are his racist views. Allow him to speak.
Milo has the right to come to any public university and express his views. If a campus tried to stop him, they would get sued and they would lose. But what we're omitting is the campus, through its officials, also has the right to speak. So if a speaker says things that are racist, I think it's the duty of the chancellor, the deans, campus officials to denounce what's said. The best response to the speech we don't like is still more speech.
All right, Janai, thanks very much for the call. We've got some listener comments here. Brian asks, we've been allowing and debating hate speech on campus for decades, and it's just getting worse. Where do you draw the line?
The debate over hate speech on campus has gone on for decades. In the early 1990s, over 300 colleges and universities adopted so-called hate speech codes to punish hate expression on campus. Every court to consider one declared it unconstitutional. It's also notable that when these codes existed, they were primarily used against the speech of minority students, the very ones they were trying to protect. Where do you draw the line? Well, free speech is protected, but if it becomes true threats, if it becomes harassment, if it becomes incitement, it's not protected. And campuses we've been talking about can have time, place, and manner restrictions.
And then Beth writes, it seems the problem we have these days is a generation who have never been, have never learned to discuss views with folks who hold different views. It's shut them up by any means possible instead. Sort of something you wouldn't describe it that way, but and we all live in silos more and more. By geography, we're separating ourselves out into blue and red parts of the country.
I'm always skeptical of people who say, but in the good old days, it was so much better. Kids today. The reality is that on campuses in the 1960s, there were efforts to try to suppress speech. That's what the free speech movement at Berkeley was all about. In the 1970s, there was the effort to try to stifle the anti-war protests on campus. The issues today are different, but the issues in every generation are different.
And let's go back to the phones now. And our next stop is San Francisco. Cynthia, you're on. Welcome.
Yes. Hi. Thank you. Could you comment on free speech and campus architecture, contrasting UCI, which was designed to prevent students from congregating freely and easily, thus preventing 60s-like protests, and UC Berkeley's architecture, which is conducive to students' collective voice?
Interesting question.
I can speak a lot more about the UC Irvine campus than the UC Berkeley campus. I spent the last 9 years at UC Irvine. I've been on the Berkeley campus 7 weeks. And I disagree with the premise. The UC Irvine campus is built around a large park, Aldridge Park. And there's a large courtyard in front of the administration building, Aldridge Hall. And there were constantly protests and demonstrations there. And that's the way it should be. And I hope that's the way it'll be on college campuses all across the country. And forever.
But it's an interesting question, though, in terms of subtle, more subtle ways that public universities and other entities can restrict speech that isn't just about the rules, but, you know, making it inconvenient or less possible to give the speech.
There's no doubt that's true.
Permits and that kind of thing.
And with regard to permits, there's clear rules. The government, a campus, can require a permit for speech. That's almost like a Robert's Rules of Order to protect order in the area. But there have to be clear criteria.
And consistent.
Consistently applied. There have to be procedural safeguards. And there can never be what we've been talking about, viewpoint discrimination, who gets a permit.
All right. So, Cynthia, thanks for the call. We had the right guest to be talking about UC Irvine, the former dean and founding dean of the law school there. 866-733-6786 is the number to call if you'd like to pose a question or comment for Dean Chemerinsky. Again, 866-733-6786. And let's go now to Stanford, another caller down there. Lauren, welcome.
Hi. Thank you. My question for Dean Chemerinsky, for Professor Chemerinsky, is – I'm really interested in his take on Trump's castigation of the press almost constantly, whether he is viewed as dangerous as he thinks it is to our First Amendment press values.
Hmm. He's been targeting as recently as yesterday or 2 days ago, the media, fake news and all that. He called them bad people, I think, the other day, reporters.
President Trump has the right to free speech. He can certainly criticize the press. He won't be the first president to criticize the press. On the other hand, some of the other actions that are being taken by the Trump administration to go to the press, to me, raise real First Amendment issues. There have been instances of the Trump administration restricting who has access to press conferences, who has access to his Twitter feed. There's a lawsuit about that. I think that clearly violates the First Amendment. When the government opens a forum, whether it's a meeting or a Twitter feed, they can't discriminate based on the viewpoint of the reporter. The Trump administration says they're going to take unprecedented action to go after those who leak information and to bring prosecutions against the press. To me, that's a real threat to what the First Amendment is all about and the free flow of information. So his criticism of the press is distasteful to me, but it's not a threat to the First Amendment by itself. It's the actions to go after the press that really strike at the core of the First Amendment.
So someone could say that he's inciting violence, or threats at least.
It doesn't meet the test for incitement. There's not an imminent likelihood of illegal activity. It's not directed at causing illegal activity. There's relatively few checks that exist against the president and society. There's Congress, there's the judiciary, there's the press. Congress hasn't done much to be a check on the president, and he's so consciously tried to undermine the legitimacy of the courts and the press, and that's troubling to me.
Lauren, thanks for the call. One other thing that has come to light recently is that the Department of Justice is looking for, wants the names and contact information, I guess, of people who went to the Disrupt J20 website, which was protesters aiming to protest the inauguration of the president. What are your thoughts about that? Is that also a free speech issue?
Very much. The United States Supreme Court has said that freedom of association is protected by the First Amendment. The court has said that compelled disclosure of association violates the First Amendment. The most famous case, NAACP versus Alabama in 1958, was when Alabama tried to require the NAACP disclose the list of its members. And the court struck that down, saying it would chill speech and association. I think going after the long list of people who might have visited a website violates the First Amendment. I think it also violates the Fourth Amendment. It's a search without any probable cause that they violated any law or evidence of violation of a law.
There are many issues and, you know, legal issues where the court has evolved over the years, whether it's, you know, gay rights, business regulations, certainly abortion. Do you see that same kind of evolution around the First Amendment about, free speech in any direction?
I think the Supreme Court has become far more pro-speech over the years. And this is a place where liberal and conservative justice come together. And so there were three free speech cases decided last year by the Supreme Court. All were unanimous.
All right, let's go back to the phones. And Carrie in San Francisco, welcome.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I feel that freedom of speech and expression are greatly needed, mainly because for a while now they've been saying that racism has gotten to a better place and we don't need affirmative action because we didn't see it. And now with Trump in office and people feeling empowered, it's not allowing individuals to voice, if we don't have it, you know, diverse opinions and get controversial ideas out there that can lead to some type of understanding of one another in a better way. So it's totally needed. I would like to know if the person sitting next to me at work has a problem with me. And if you don't see that it exists, you believe it's no longer necessary to protect people from it.
Dean Chemerinsky?
I want to take your example of affirmative action. Several of the callers have said, why do we need to protect hate speech? Well, imagine that there's in power people who very much believe that affirmative action is an illegal form of discrimination. Might they, if they could suppress speech, then stop those who support affirmative action from being able to express themselves? This is why we have to protect expression of all viewpoints. Now, of course, in the workplace, it's a very different set of rules, and especially if it's a private workplace, the First Amendment doesn't apply at all.
Thanks very much for the call. What are your thoughts, though, about, you know, we just down in Silicon Valley, the Google engineer, James Damore, I think his name is, was fired over a controversial email memo he wrote about diversity policies and women in tech. That is a private company. But, you know, what are the legal issues there, if any? He's hired a lawyer.
You put your finger on it. The First Amendment doesn't apply to Google. If it was the city of San Francisco or the state of California, they fired him for a speech, it's a very different situation. So they have the constitutional right to do so. Now, he might be able to argue wrongful termination. He might be able to argue breach of contract with Google. But it's not a free speech issue under the First Amendment.
Let me ask you about another issue that's been in the news today. It's in the news again. And it has to do with former 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick, who famously took a knee during the national anthem. He's now not working. No team has hired him. A lot of people feel he's been blackballed, blacklisted, whatever you want to phrase you want to use. What are the legal issues there, if any?
It's hard to make it a legal issue. Colin Kaepernick certainly, I believe, should be able to stand or not stand for the national anthem. It's a way of expressing himself. But pro football teams are private. They're not covered by the First Amendment. Also, I think it would be very difficult to prove that the reason he's not being hired, signed on to a team, is because of his views as opposed to their assessment of his ability, even though we all have a sense of what's really going on.
Let's read a couple of listener comments here. Amy tweets, Dean Irwin, thanks very much. I appreciate your enthusiasm and positivity. You're so right that everything starts with including all views. And Bruce writes, it's fascinating. The Berkeley and the Golden Gate National Recreation Area have worked with white supremacists and reactionaries to ensure their First Amendment rights, while San Francisco has trouble issuing a permit to allow a 50th anniversary Summer of Love celebration. Is that not an expression of free speech? Two, where are our priorities? We're short on time, but what are you going to be doing this weekend? Are you going to be observing all of this expression of free speech? Are you going to be, there? Are you going to be going up to Lake Tahoe to get away from it all?
One of the wonderful things coming in as Dean at Berkeley is we're hosting a series of dinners at our house for all of the first-year students, all of the staff, all of the faculty. So we've now hosted 5 dinners for over 100 people. We have 3 more to go between tonight through the weekend. And this is a wonderful effort to try to build community in an institution that we're just joining.
Is there a lot of disagreement at those dinners?
We've had 5 so far, and it's just a wonderful occasion for people to get together and also for us to get to meet people in our new community.
All right. Irwin Chemerinsky, thanks so much for coming in. Good to meet you. Good luck in your new job. He, along with Howard Gilman, have written the new book, Free Speech on Campus. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauerberg, and Susan Britton. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer is Katie McMurrin. Our engagement producers are Amanda Stupai and Devin Holt. And we get online support from Amanda Font and Ryan Levy. Our interns are Anna Sterla and Patrick Fitzgerald. Our managing editor is Ethan Lindsay, and our executive producer is Holly Kernan. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Michael Krasny. Mina Kim will be here tomorrow. Thanks so much for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.